This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, we're going to take a deep dive into the world of batteries, from the ones that power electric vehicles to the ones that help cut and combat climate change. Have you got a question about new battery technologies coming down the pike? Charge up those phones and give us a call. Our number, 844-724-8255. 844-SCI-TALK, or tweet us at SciFry. But first, this week, the U.S. Patent Office ruled in favor of the Broad Institute in a case over the rights to the gene editing technique known as CRISPR. Now, as you know, CRISPR technique allows scientists to search and replace specific genetic sequences in a genome. It's a very new and important tool, and the rights to CRISPR have been the subject of intense legal battles between the Broad Institute and the University of California, home to CRISPR pioneer Jennifer Doudna. Speaking in a press conference Wednesday, Doudna said that the ruling was not the end of the story and that the University of California would likely win a patent over the broader use of the technology. She said, quote, "They have a patent on green tennis balls. We have a patent on all tennis balls," she said. Here to discuss, she's not playing any tennis, is IEEE Spectrum's Amy Nordstrom. Welcome. You don't play tennis, do you?
I used to play tennis.
Tell us what this tennis ball, what is the whole reference there to?
Sure. So the issue in this argument, this patent debate, really centered on 13 core patents that had previously been awarded to a researcher named Feng Zhang of the Broad Institute of MIT and Harvard in Boston. So these patents describe the use of CRISPR to splice and edit genes in living eukaryotic cells, which are those cells with the nucleus like the ones that we find in plants and animals. Now, the University of California and Jennifer Doudna's group were claiming that Zhang's research and findings covered by those patents were kind of a logical extension of some earlier work that she had done and for which she had applied for a patent previously completed in 2012 at the University of California. So they're basically saying that Zhang's work was a logical extension that followed off of their own work, and they deserve the patent and the rights for that work. So obviously the patent office ruled in the favor of the Broad Institute and Zhang, and so those 13 patents were upheld. And this puts the University of California in an interesting position. So they will continue to try to seek their own patent as well. But as you said, it may apply to a broader use, whereas this Zhang patent is more specifically focused on living eukaryotic cells, which is where we see a lot of the potential for genetic editing techniques in the future in disease and human medicine.
So if you're a researcher or a company doing research and you want to use the CRISPR technology, who do you pay the royalties?
So already companies have sort of lined up on either side of this debate. I mean, they've already been trying to pursue their own clinical trials and line up the patenting and licensing necessary to do so. So we've already got companies on sort of both sides of the debate that have paid for and licensed CRISPR from both the University of California and the Broad Institute. So now there's a lot of enthusiasm for those that chose the Broad before this final decision was made. Mm. And now there's a lot of uncertainty on the other side about whether those who'd lined up with the University of California and that licensing would have to be, you know, revisited, or perhaps they'd have to seek the license now from the Broad as well.
It's just something the lawyers must love.
Yes, it's very interesting, and there's a lot of money on the line. This is expected to be a multi-billion-dollar industry.
Wow! All right, let's move on to you to a story you have about a satellite launch, but not just any launch. Tell us about that one.
That's right. So this week in India, a rocket launched carrying 104 satellites, and that sets a new world record for the most satellites packed onto a single rocket for one launch in the history. So this was interesting because they carried so many satellites at once, and this is possible because satellite technology has really become much smaller, more compact, almost like our smartphone technology now has more computing power than many early computers did. So the satellites aboard this rocket were packed in and deployed at three different spots during the launch in three different orbits in order to do things like weather monitoring, satellite imagery, and possibly some use for defense as well in the future.
So this is not just one all-purpose to do one task. You can use each and every one of them for something else.
Right. Like, so different countries had loaded these satellites up for different purposes. One company in particular, actually a U.S. company named Planet, had 88 of these satellites on board for their own private constellation. What they're trying to do is image the entire Earth every single day, and they're hoping that these 88 satellites will help them reach that goal.
Number 88 keeps popping up a lot of times. Let's talk about, we heard a lot earlier this week about the Oroville Dam in California And we saw pictures of it on TV. It looked pretty spooky. Has the danger now passed? Is the water back down?
Well, there's good news, and then there's also reason for caution with the Orville Dam story. So this dam is the tallest in America. It's 40 feet taller than the Hoover Dam, so it's massive. And this week it reached 100% capacity due to some heavy rains that had been falling in the area. So the dam was relying on its main spillway, which is sort of an overflow channel for water to come off of the lake when the dam is at capacity. But that first spillway had experienced some erosion, and so they needed to move to a second spillway that they only really typically use in emergency situations. And they were soon finding that spillway was also being subject to some erosion. And so they were worried about some failure issues, potential failure in the spillways, which could cause some flooding in the valleys below. So earlier this week, California officials had suggested that 180,000 people evacuate the area. Those people were able to return home as of Wednesday, but the officials aren't really sure that everything is in the clear yet. They've been doing some repairs by dumping a bunch of rocks in three main areas.
It's a giant hole in that spillway.
Yeah. So there were three that were kind of being filled in with rocks, and the dam is now about 32 feet below its top level, which is really good news, but there's rain in the forecast until Tuesday in the area, so they're asking residents to remain really cautious.
So finally, you have a story called, Where's My Flying Car?
That's right.
We're always promised one every generation, right?
Every generation.
Are we going to have one now?
So Dubai is pretty convinced that they're going to have one this year. So this week, the head of the transportation agency in Dubai made an announcement saying that their city government expects to work with a Chinese company called Ehang to bring the first autonomous passenger drones to the city this summer. So they're expecting to have drones that can fly one person carrying one small piece of baggage, such as a suitcase, in and around Dubai. And this is a pretty bold claim. We haven't actually seen this technology work with a person inside of it before, but we do know that the drone exists and that, you know, it's likely that they can do what they say they are going to do. The safety issue is another big question, though. We're not We're not really sure how this drone would maneuver through buildings, for example, or avoid other drones in the air. We're not entirely sure what would happen if the propellers on the drone were to fail or if the software inside the drone were to fail. I'm sure there's redundancies there, but we need to learn a lot more about the technology.
We do. I'll wait for someone else to test it out.
That's probably a good idea.
Thank you, Amy. Amy Nordstrom is associate editor at the IEEE Spectrum. And now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. Ever been at a party talking to a new friend and wishing you had a better sense of whether they were happy, sad, or bored by what you were saying? Well, in an episode of the CBS show The Big Bang Theory, one of its main characters, Sheldon Cooper, was given a device that would help him read the emotions of people in the room. And for those with severe social anxiety or even Asperger syndrome, reading those subtle social cues can be a genuine struggle. And in a classic case of life imitating art, now a team at MIT's Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Lab has a possible solution, a wearable wrist device that could clue users in how their conversations partners are feeling. Here to explain and share some of the good and bad of that is Daniel Oberhaus, science writer based in Phoenix. He's covering the story for Motherboard. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, thanks for having me.
How did these researchers teach their AI to read emotions?
Yeah, so what they did was they had 31 undergraduates come in to their lab at MIT, and they would tell a story that would, you know, be a couple minutes long. And the researchers, while the students were telling the story, would have them wear a armband that would monitor their vitals, such as their skin temperature, blood pressure, heart rate, things like that, while also recording the story on an iPhone. The students would then tell the researchers whether they would self-report whether they found the story to be happy or sad. And then after the fact, they would use this to train a neural network they had developed to recognize whether other stories were happy or sad based on the students' responses. And it turns out the machine was actually pretty good at doing it. Had about an 83% success rate. Wasn't so great at picking out smaller chunks in the story out of context to determine whether they're happy or sad, but it's getting there. So.
Could the machine in real time tell you what the state of the emotions are?
Not quite yet. And so I think that's kind of where they want to get to the point where if you were talking to someone in conversation, it might signal your cell phone to kind of give you a vibration to let you know maybe you're boring the person, and the machine can tell that based on their heart rate or something. Yeah.
Yeah. And so the good news is that they're developing this. The bad news is that we're not sure how well it works yet.
I mean, they know it works pretty well. It's just hard to implement in a real life scenario. And like when you imagine these things, they're going to be this AI wearable that both people might have to wear to have it really be effective, which, wearing these things might actually make a situation more socially awkward than it was in the first place. So, I mean, getting some test cases for this is going to be, I think, interesting.
How does it know between, people cry happy crying and they're happy and mostly, or they cry, sad crying? Can it distinguish from things like that?
It's at a pretty low level of emotional granularity. So it's just kind of happy or sad. And I think what's really interesting, you'd have to talk to the researchers about how the machine actually knows, because a lot of times when people tell a story, the story might be entirely sad for 90% of it. And then right at the end, something happens that makes the story turn out to actually be a happy story. And so I think that, to me, is really the interesting aspect of this, is how a machine is able to learn this. And the researchers are hoping that eventually, once they have a bigger data set, it will be able to be applied with much finer emotional granularity to the point where, you can tell if the story was exciting or funny.
Of course, we want to make sure the data is safe, right? And not going to be shared with everybody.
Mm-hmm. And the researchers were thinking a lot about that as well. All the information that's being collected is stored locally on the device. It's not connected to the internet. So
that's good to hear. Daniel, thank you for taking time to be with us today. It's an interesting story.
Of course.
Daniel Oberhaus, a science writer based in Phoenix, Arizona. Coming up, we're plugging into the world of battery research. We're really geeking out this hour on devices and stuff. Is there a new battery out there that can beat the lithium-ion battery for electric vehicles? We're going to find out next and talk about everything you ever wanted to know about what's new in battery research. It's coming along slowly, but there are new developments. We will talk about them. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're kicking off this, I could call it a battery fest hour, because we're going to talk about so many different things about batteries. And just about every major automaker has or is developing an electric vehicle. Tesla, it's the most well-known, right? But there are EVs from Nissan and Chevy and BMW on the road. None would be possible, though, without the lithium-ion battery. You'll buy these batteries in the store, right? You know what I'm talking about. Lithium-ion is the most popular battery type for electric vehicles also. They can last these cars up to 200 miles on a single charge, and it's not too expensive to make, which makes EVs relatively affordable. But experts say that's just not quite good enough. To beat out the more populous combustion engine cars, electric vehicles will need a battery makeover. Not just some tweaks here or there, but perhaps a whole new type of battery to take it to the finish line. So, what's the next EV battery going to look like? Magnesium ion, lithium sulfur? Now, there are dozens of battery chemistries to play with, but how many of them even approach the success of the lithium ion? And how long will it take us to get there? Here to help answer those questions are my next guests. Chelsea Sexton is an electric vehicle expert and co-founder of Plug in America. She's been an advisor to numerous auto companies and was featured in that documentary. Remember that great documentary, Who Killed the Electric Car? Welcome to Science Friday, Chelsea.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. George Crabtree is a senior scientist and director of the Joint Center for Energy Storage Research at Argonne National Laboratory. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks, Ira and Chelsea.
Let's talk, Chelsea. How are EVs stacking up against gas-powered cars right now? Are they making any inroads, so to speak?
Slowly but surely, we're making inroads with electric vehicles. Right now, the number one thing holding us back is actually lack of product. And by that, I mean variety, things beyond just smaller, compact cars, because people want different levels of performance and body style and SUVs and all of those things that we look for in traditional gasoline vehicles. And so we're edging slowly but surely towards that variety, but it's taking a little while to get there.
Now, I understand there's sort of a debate over whether EVs are truly better for the environment than gas-powered cars. Some people have suggested it takes a couple of years of owning an EV to offset the emissions it took to make it. Is that correct?
Well, it depends on who you ask, but the studies across the board that have been done so far show that even on sort of a soup-to-nuts, cradle-to-grave type of basis, driving an electric car is better for the environment than a gasoline car by around 40%. It depends a little bit on where that energy comes from, but even on a nationwide basis in the U.S. today, EVs are much cleaner than gasoline cars, and they have the unique benefit that they can only ever get cleaner because the grid can only get cleaner, in addition to options like getting your own solar panels and stuff. Mm-hmm. So the cool thing about an EV from a environmental standpoint is the dirtiest day it will ever have is the day you drive it home, and it can only get cleaner from there.
Mm. All right, George, let's get right into the battery technology. What makes the lithium ion the best for powering electric cars?
Well, you know, Ira, the lithium ion battery has been around for about 25 years. And of course, it was a huge success for personal electronics, really revolutionized the way we deal with each other through our smartphones. The question is, can it do the same thing for cars? And of course, the battery in your cell phone is way smaller than the battery you would need for your car. And we require much more out of the car battery in terms of driving range and safety and chargeability than we do from our cell phone battery. So I think the lithium-ion battery has come down in price enormously in the last 5 years, and that's really what allows Tesla and GM to bring out cars that cost only $35,000 and will go 200 miles. But the question is, can it really compete? And I think you asked the right question, what's next? There are some things that are much better. In fact, Jay Caesar attempts to make batteries. We want to invent the battery that's five times better and five times cheaper than lithium-ion batteries. And such things are quite possible. It's just that they're kind of high risk. And so most research organizations and companies don't want to take the risk. They'd rather go with the standard lithium-ion.
All right, let's get into what the possibilities are. Chelsea, what battery technologies look the most promising to you?
Well, I think there's a lot of them on the horizon, as you said, that involve magnesium and sulfur and different components, often as a flavor variation on the current lithium-ion batteries. So not all of them are wholly new chemistries. And it's worth noting that we spent about 100 years on lead acid and then around 10 years or so on nickel metal hydride. And lithium is the most promising at the moment, in part because, as was mentioned, the price has been dropping so much, such that in the next 5 to 7 years or so, it's expected that electric vehicles will actually reach cost parity with gasoline cars. And so therefore, by sort of mid to late 2020s, it'll be cheaper to make an EV than a gas car, even on today's batteries. So as exciting and promising as a lot of things are in the lab, there's also the aspect of the time it will take to scale and also what some of the trade-offs are. Some of them are great thermally and preventing thermal runaway, but at the same time, there are often trade-offs in cost or density, other aspects that make them better or worse for electric vehicles versus grid storage, for example. Mm-hmm.
George, you're working right now on a couple of promising candidates?
Yeah, we have a five-year charter. 4 years are gone. We have 1 year left to finish our job. But a year ago, we selected two prototypes for transportation. One is lithium sulfur, and one is a magnesium battery. You've mentioned both of those before, Ira. And they both have at least the potential to give you five times the driving range on one charge and cost one-fifth as much. When it comes to the cell phone, the cost is really not the major factor because the cost of a cell phone is mostly something else. But when it comes to the electric vehicle, the cost is really, really important. So the difference between $80,000, which is what a Tesla costs, a Tesla that would go 200 miles, cost until recently, and 35, which is what it soon will cost when the Model 3 comes out, is basically the cost of the lithium-ion battery. That's the amount by which it's gone down. So these lithium sulfur and magnesium batteries have the chance to be even five times cheaper. And I think this is a point that we need to think about. Chelsea mentioned some of the downsides and the fact that by the late 20s, they may be at cost parity with gasoline cars, but they may not still have all the service. So one of the things that people complain the most about is charging time. So if you charge your car at home with just an outlet from the wall, it can take you 6 or 8 hours to get a full charge on it. And that's just not the same, not even close to a gasoline car, which you can fill up in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
So some of these other issues, I think, are besides cost and besides range, are actually quite important.
844-724-8255 is our number. Let's see if we can take a call from, let's go to Philly. And Yvonne, hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, hi, Ira.
Hey there, go ahead.
I wanted to mention supercapacitors. Apparently there's a new technology out of the University of Surrey that it's a supercapacitor that is an order of magnitude much more powerful than standard battery technology these days. And of course it would charge much quicker than any battery on the market.
Well, let me ask, thanks for calling. Let me ask my guests, have you heard of, why not supercapacitors, George?
A great question, and supercapacitors have been around for a while, maybe not as advanced as the one from Surrey that we just heard about, but there's one downside. They don't store a lot of charge, so although they're way faster than batteries for charging and discharging, and that's really quite useful in many applications, if you want the driving range, you need a battery in addition to the supercapacitor. You hear, especially in the UK, about cars that would combine batteries and supercapacitors to be able to do everything. So drive a long way and also pass a truck while going uphill. And in that case, you would engage the supercapacitor, which would give you the power you need.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think they can do it by themselves, at least not yet.
George, do you agree with Chelsea how long it'll take before we replace the lithium-ion battery?
Well, that's hard to predict. It's a great question. It depends on research. So in our work, we're hoping to have a prototype, and we expect to have a prototype by the end of this year. That would be December 2017. And let's say we did that, and it achieved our factors of five improvement that we're shooting for. We would then pass that to a manufacturer who would make a scale-up prototype 10 times bigger, just to prove that you could make it at the product size that you needed. And then he would, if that were successful, he would mm-hmm. make another prototype, which would be another factor of 10 bigger, which would be the actual product prototype that you put under the hood. That could take between 5 and 10 years, depends on how fast it goes. So even if the proof of principle is ready at the end of this year, as we expect, you won't see them, you know, the following year in your car.
Mm-hmm. Is that why companies like Toyota are betting on fuel cells instead, because it might be faster to develop a fuel cell than it would to find new batteries?
Yeah, that is such a great question. And of course, I'm sure you know that this year you can buy the Toyota Mirai, which is a fuel cell car. Interesting to compare them to an electric car. So the fuel cell runs on hydrogen, you can easily store enough hydrogen in a compressed gas tank to get you 300 miles or more. So range is basically no problem. However, there are no hydrogen filling stations around, or very few. So it's a little harder to fill up. And as a practical matter, you'd have to drive it close to home where you could recharge it. Just the opposite of an electric car, which has a little trouble with range. 200 miles is interesting and maybe enough, but it's not close to a gasoline car and not close to the 300 miles that a hydrogen car would do. But you can charge it anywhere. There's electricity all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of interesting how that's going to play out.
Mm-hmm. Chelsea, I understand that there were electric vehicles around since the early 1900s. Whatever happened to that whole idea?
Well, I think Charles Kettering originally killed the electric car. Now, EVs were very, very popular around the turn of the century, and specifically with women. They're kind of the first chick cars because they were clean and quiet and smooth, and they didn't need to be cranked, most importantly. And that was one of the reasons that they were favored. And then when the electric starter was engineered for gasoline vehicles, and they no longer needed cranking, and they had long range, and there wasn't an issue around charging stations in rural areas and things like that, then gas cars started to take over. But in the last few decades, there have been kind of a resurgence around EVs. And it's a unique example in the history of the automotive industry. It's the one type of car where the industry has always required demand to predate and continually exceed supply. And what that sounds like is every time you've heard an automaker say, when we see demand, we'll build electric cars, which has never been true for hybrids or hydrogen or SUVs or pretty much any retail product on the planet. So it's unique in being a very sort of advocate and consumer-driven effort until we can get enough market momentum to actually be self-sustaining.
But we have Nissan and Chevy and BMW, not to mention Tesla, already in the market. Are they just feeling, you know, putting their toe in and afraid to really jump in a big way? Is that what you're saying?
I think they're starting slowly, and new technology is expensive. At the same time, aside from Tesla, the rest of the automakers have a lot of sort of core investment in internal combustion. And the way that they're structured and the way that they're paid and their incentive programs and all of those sorts of things are not geared towards let's transform into something really quickly that we're not going to make a lot of money on right away.
Right.
And, which is part of why we see the entire auto industry besides Tesla currently lobbying our new president to keep doing the old stuff and not have to do so much of the new things. So they'll get there, but in order to really create some transformation and give people the products they want, we need more than two or three automakers.
Right.
There's no single gas car on the road for everybody, and the same will be true for EVs.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking about electric vehicles with Chelsea Sexton and George Crabtree. What surprises me most about the whole electric vehicle industry is that there's no common charging plug. I mean, if you're going to drive any of these cars across the country, we don't go into a gas station and have five different, you know, gas pumps to use. Is there any effort to, you know, if you want to make it popular, you can go into anybody's charging plug? It sounds kind of wacky to me. What do you think of that, George?
That's a great comment, Ira. And I think we need to shake out the standards for charging. In fact, not only plugs, but there are lots of charging mechanisms. So you can charge at home and take 6 or 8 hours. You can charge with a higher voltage, 240 or even higher, and do it in a few hours. And you can do a DC charge in maybe an hour. But those are hard to find. You'll never do that at home. That you have to find a turbocharging station. And the question of plugs is also a barrier. So Tesla, of course, wants to keep their own charging stations, and they don't want anyone else using them. Only Tesla owners can use them. We'll have to see how that plays out. Will that really work, or is it better to have a standard?
Tweet from Robert coming in. It says, what happens to the car batteries after they stop holding a charge? What do you do with them?
Great question. And lots of people ask that. In fact, if you look at how long the lithium ion batteries are guaranteed, it's about 8 years. And that's a legal issue. I mean, that's required by law. But a car lasts 15 or 16. So if you're the kind of person that really wants the most performance out of your car after 8 years, you may have to replace the battery, which could be something between $5,000 and $20,000, depending on what car you have. And then there's the question of what would you do with that battery if it still was pretty good but not good enough for the car. One of the most interesting proposals that I've heard is use it on the grid. So take it out of the car and put it along with hundreds of other automotive batteries in a shed somewhere at a substation or at a generating station, and use it on the grid to back up wind and solar or various things like that.
Chelsea?
Yeah, I mean, what George said, and there's some interesting implications in that, where if you, for example, were General Motors and you knew that Southern California Edison would buy X number of kilowatt hours of your used Bolt batteries, you could possibly amortize the cost of those batteries over a couple of uses and lower the cost of the car up front. So the reuse issue is still very, very nascent. Nissan is experimenting with it in Hawaii and in Los Angeles and in Japan, but the economics of it still have to be resolved a little bit. But it's virtually unacceptable in the minds of most working on this that batteries would come out of cars and certainly not go into landfills, but necessarily even be immediately recycled, that they probably would have two or three uses over their lifetime.
Yeah.
And charging does remain kind of an interesting challenge. But right now, the current solution is just to put both connectors on every charging station out there as much as we can, just like you have a gas nozzle and a diesel nozzle in a gas station. At the same time, we have to be a little careful about forcing future mobility to behave exactly past mobility.
All right, we got to go. Chelsea Sexton, electric vehicle expert, co-founder of Plug in America. She's been a numerous advisor to a lot of companies. She's featured in Who Killed the Electric Car? George Crabtree, senior scientist, director of the Joint Center for Energy Storage Research at Argonne National Laboratory. Thank you both for taking time to be with us. When we come back, we're still going. We're going to come back and talk more about battery talk, and David Pogue is going to join us. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. We're talking about battery power this hour, the future limitations of new batteries, old batteries. You know, lithium-ion batteries do power electric vehicles, but they've also been in the news in a very unflattering way as the culprit behind the exploding Samsung Galaxy Note phones. That's because what makes lithium-ion such a popular battery for powering our electronics is also the thing that makes it highly combustible. It's very high energy density. And any flaw, even just a drop of water, can short the system and turn your device into a dangerous fireball. So, here again, researchers are asking, is there something better than the lithium-ion battery? But cars are not the only focus. Think bigger, much bigger. Batteries on a larger scale have the potential to provide the electric grid with something that is sorely needed, a way to store energy. And my next guest explored the wide world of batteries, from the ones that power your devices to ones that could help combat climate change, all in a NOVA documentary, The Search for the Super Battery. David Pogue, tech columnist for Yahoo Finance, correspondent for NOVA and CBS Sunday Morning and Scientific American. Good to have you back, David.
Why, thank you so much, sir.
We just talked a lot about the limitations of lithium ion as an EV battery, and it sounds like there are similar drawbacks to those batteries powering our devices.
There are indeed. Lithium ion is not the best storage device. There are chemistries that have better energy density. They are explosive. They are expensive. They have a limited life in two ways. They have a limited, you know, amount of hours they can power your phone, and they can only be recharged, let's say, 400 times before they start. So the world really needs something better than this 1991 technology.
Could fill us in a bit of what actually happened with that Galaxy Note phone, and why is the battery like a ticking time bomb inside it?
Yeah, the word bomb is not out of place here. A lithium-ion battery is a positive and a negative electrode, you know, an anode and a cathode, separated by a liquid. It is a flammable. It's basically kerosene. It's the electrolyte liquid inside every phone. We are carrying a bomb around in our pockets. Absolutely. On YouTube, you can go and watch people jabbing at these batteries removed from their phones and tablets with a screwdriver or a hammer, and they explode. I mean, they explode. There are these montages on YouTube. Mm-hmm. So the only thing that keeps them from blowing up all the time, first of all, there's controller circuitry that makes sure that it doesn't charge or discharge too much. And also, these things are manufactured in incredibly controlled, expensive clean room conditions, zero humidity, zero dust. As you pointed out, the slightest imperfection in that electrolyte will make it unstable and will make it blow up. So what happened with Samsung is one of their subsidiaries provided the batteries, and they had a tiny imperfection. I mean, not just a drop of water. I mean, a particle of water is all it would take. And then they recalled all the notes, and they found a new supplier for the batteries, and, you know, perfect storm. The same thing happened. So it was just really bad luck and some bad design.
So you explored in your series on NOVA a whole bunch of stuff, different kinds of batteries. What is a good candidate? Are there good candidates out there for replacing lithium-ion batteries?
Well, that's the cool thing. I mean, to be totally honest with you, when NOVA told me they wanted me to host an hour-long show about battery chemistries, I'm like, oh, yeah, there's a bestseller right there. But you know what? I was so wrong. Some of the coolest things we looked at, ice batteries and gravity batteries and flywheel batteries and saltwater batteries and and dirt batteries. It's just billions of dollars are being poured into this in research labs all over the world. We spent a whole week in Detroit, of course, the hub of the American electric car industry, or part of the hub. And there's a lot of work being done there. I mean, I could speak for 3 hours about some of the cooler things, but maybe I should tell you about the most promising thing we saw is at Tufts University, a plastics professor, a polymer professor named Mike Zimmerman, has decided, well, if the problem is this explosive liquid in all our batteries, why don't we get rid of the explosive liquid? He's made a solid sheet of a special plastic, a special polymer, that lets the ions travel back and forth between the electrodes even better than a liquid electrolyte does. And yet, because it's a physical barrier, you can't short out like lithium-ion batteries can. So these are plastic electrode batteries. And to make matters even better, because there's physically no way for a short circuit to occur, he can replace the lithium-ion material, the compounds he's using, with actual lithium metal, which we know to have 5 times more energy density than the compound we use now. But of course, it's 5 times more explosive as well, so we don't use it. But he can, and already he's getting double the length, the power density of lithium ion. So think of a car, you know, now instead of going 200 miles on a charge, it can go 400 miles on a charge.
Wow.
And your phone, instead of charging it every day and a half, you can charge it every 3 days. So he, on the show, you'll see, he had me, he pulled out one of these batteries from an iPad and from a smartphone of his chemistry, and he had me stab at it with a screwdriver, and he took another one and had me cut up pieces away with scissors while it was powering an LED light panel. Like, not only did it not blow up in my face, but the light panel stayed on.
Wow.
Until I'd cut this thing into a paper doll.
So why haven't we got this battery? I mean, what's holding it back?
I have a feeling you will soon. It was greatly delightful to us to find out that we were the first media he'd ever had in his lab. It's been under wraps for 3 years, basically. And I said, why aren't Samsungs and Apples beating a path to your door? And he goes, you know who was here yesterday? Samsung. So
you're having an effect.
There.
Yes, it
is. Yeah. He says the only thing stopping him is scaling up.
Right.
In other words, there's no such thing as a lithium metal battery factory. No one's done that. Yeah. So that's it.
I guess the lawyers are also working on the patent for this before they want to let it out of his sight. Let's go to the phones to San Mateo, California. Mark, hi. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. So I'm in a battery technology startup, and we are using ceramic semiconductor metal glass alloy electrodes and saline-based solid-state-based electrolyte. And it was working very well. The saline, this, like the salt water batteries, have a low energy density, except that they have high amperage capacity, and we can exploit that. And so we're looking at 700 watt-hours per kilogram estimated. We don't have the right equipment yet to do a really accurate test. And it goes up from there. The modeling shows going up to well over a kilowatt-hour per kilogram.
Hmm. So you're working on something.
So the interesting thing about what your caller is saying is that one of the big focuses of Search for the Super Battery was not batteries in our gadgets and our cars, but on the grid. Of course, right now, when you turn on your light, that electricity is not waiting in your wires like water waits in your pipes. It has to be generated in real time. And that's a problem for solar and wind, which are intermittent sources. So we need a way to capture solar and wind power so that it'll be there when we need it. And you can't use lithium-ion batteries. So my point here is that we don't need small, compact, and lightweight when it comes to grid batteries. They
right.
can be much lower energy density. They can be salt water and other chemistries and really big and ugly and huge because they don't move. But as long as they are, you know, environmentally clean and they store the energy and last for many years, that's just what we need. So that's what's cool about things like saltwater batteries.
Mm-hmm. Now, we see that Elon Musk and his company are creating these gigafactories to build the batteries. Are they flexible enough, do you know, if they, to suddenly change? What if something better comes along and they're all tooled up to do what they're doing? Can they just switch and change to make a better battery?
That's a great question. Yeah, the Gigafactory, they're building it in Nevada. It's well underway. When it's done, it will be the largest building in the world. It'll be bigger than a Boeing, you know, airplane factory. And they say that it'll make lithium-ion batteries. It'll pop them out, quote, faster than a machine gun shooting bullets.
Wow.
So the question is, when better chemistries come along, can they retool? I mean, I'm hoping that they've thought this through. I assume that they can just change the machines when the time comes.
I also saw that that some people are still working on the flywheel battery. Now, I remember back in the 60s, it was a cover of one of the magazines had a flywheel car on, and I actually went out to California to see it in the 70s. And, you know, it was made out of epoxy, and it spun up at all thousands of RPM. They're still working on this idea?
They are, and very, very successfully. We've had flywheel batteries that can store energy for a few seconds or maybe a minute, but this company called Amber Kinetics out in California has one. It's a 5,000-pound steel wheel spinning at 8,500 RPM. There's no friction because it's suspended by a magnet and in a vacuum canister. So there's zero friction. This thing would spin for weeks if you didn't touch it. But the idea is at night, when energy is very cheap, at night we use so little electricity that some plants actually burn it off. They waste it.
Okay.
Because there's no way to store it without batteries. So the idea is that they will spin these flywheels up at night using this basically free electricity. And then during the day, when we all wake up and turn on our appliances, the motor will reverse and become a generator and capture that kinetic motion and turn it back into energy. And these things can store 4 hours at a time.
Wow.
And what we didn't have time to mention on the show is that this is a real thing. PG&E, the biggest utility in California, has ordered a $20 million order of these things. They're going to build this whole field of them, by the way, buried under gravel, because the only possible downside of these things is if they fly apart, they would kill everybody within a mile.
Yeah.
So they bury them in gravel, and they're giving it a try this spring.
One of the problems they had in the cars when they actually had them in the cars was that you have a tremendous gyroscopic effect. You couldn't turn the car with this giant spinning wheel in it. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with David Pogue on Science Friday. We're talking about batteries. Let's see if we can get a phone call or two in here. Hey, let's go to Sarah in Coventry, Connecticut. Hi, Sarah.
Hi there. David, I was wondering if you could speak to what, if any, focus is really being placed on making sure that the research and development of materials and the human power and all of the transportation, everything in the systems engineering side of things, what kind of focus is being placed on making sure that the footprint, the carbon footprint of all of these new technologies is minimal as possible? I know as a consumer, I would love to support any kind of company that would, you know, give a cleaner material, but also in the future, make sure that it is not producing secondary kind of, you know, carbon footprint problems and just simply, you know, kicking the can down the road or replacing the issues that we're having with the oil and gas industry today.
Right. Excellent question. So this Nova special is called The Search for the Super Battery. You can just Google it. It's available to watch free online. But it's called that because there's no battery that has everything. You want it cheap. You want it to last for a long time, you want high energy density, and you want it to be environmentally friendly, both during its lifetime and after it's done. You want to be able to recycle it. You don't want it to be toxic in the landfill. So every battery scientist we spoke to is painfully aware of these five or six competing interests, and you can't have it all. So as we were saying, you can get cheap and long-lasting for an energy plant, but it's not going to be mobile and lightweight. And so to answer your question more directly, all of this is in the name of the environment, all of it. Electric cars, battery storage for power plants that will allow them to use renewable energy. All of this is ultimately in the name of a cleaner environment. But all of them are also worrying a lot about what happens to these materials when they're done. So I asked Mike Zimmerman, the plastic electrolyte guy, about that. And he nodded and he said, okay, this round, these ones are no better than lithium ion. When they're done, they're done. But that's, you know, at the top of our to-do list. The next generation, we hope, will be more recyclable.
Right, so we really don't know who, you know, who has the magic formula yet. There's still so much competition.
Yeah, I suspect it'll be, you know, specialized batteries with different characteristics for different purposes.
And what's interesting, we were talking before about what happens to electric vehicle batteries. They might be able to put them back on the grid and use as partial storage devices.
Exactly. That's a great idea. And by the way, these plastic electrolyte batteries, Mike Zimmerman's batteries, are also perfect for cars, he says, because A, they don't explode, and B, they carry at least double the energy density.
Mm-hmm. So you're not, you know, set on what you think. You think he has a leg up on the next battery? The plastic battery looks pretty good?
The answer is yes. I mean, I've seen it with my eyes. I've seen it in an iPad. I've seen it in a phone. I've tried to make it blow up. It doesn't. At the same time, I have to say, we spent a year shooting this special, and we went all over the country, and there are lots and lots and lots of exciting developments and people saying they have the next thing, and all kinds of things can derail the process. You know, so can't promise anything, but I have to say, this Ionic Materials, that's Mike Zimmerman's company, that battery is, it just blows everybody's mind.
Mm-hmm. And we'll see how much money still goes to government battery research in this new administration. Find out about that later.
Don't kill me now.
All right. David Pocock, tech columnist for Yahoo Finance, correspondent for Nova, CBS Sunday Morning, Scientific American, plays the piano on the side. And he's also he's the correspondent, I guess, in the search for the super battery, and Nova documentary still on. Thank you, David. Always good to have you.
Thank you so much.
Charles Berquist is our director. Our senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Christy Taylor, Katie Heiler. Luke Gruskin is our video producer. Rich Kim, our technical director, Sarah Fishman, and Jack Horowitz, our engineers. At the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. If you'd like to write us, send your letters. We like to take classically mailed mail. Science Friday, 19 West 44th Street, Room 412, New York, New York, 10036. You can also email us, scifry@sciencefriday.com. And, of course, you can also reach us on our Facebook page and tweet us all week long. So we're here every day of the week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.